Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is evil? It seems likely that human beings have struggled to answer this question for as long as we have understood a difference between right and wrong. But while the concept of evil has been explored and explained by philosophers and religious leaders, my guest today would remind us that it is not a precise scientific term. So he has set out to define it for research purposes and come to the conclusion that it begins with a lack of empathy and is translated into destructive action through a combination of negative factors in an individual's environment. Simon Baron-Cohen is professor of developmental psychopathology and director of the Autism Research Center at the University of Cambridge. His new book is called The Science of Evil, On Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. Simon, welcome to Think.
Thanks. Nice to be on the show.
Let's start with this. What makes the term evil so unhelpful from a scientific perspective?
Well, when you analyze the word evil, really it's just another way of saying that somebody did something bad. So evil is often used as the absence of good. So if you're trying to explain why somebody did something bad and you use the term evil, it gets a bit circular. It's simply saying he or she did something bad because they are bad. It doesn't really take you any further. So from a scientist's point of view, it's a bit frustrating. Scientists want to get underneath behavior or underneath phenomena to find out about causes.
Do you think the circularity of that definition is part of the reason that until fairly recently, we've sort of left it up to the realm of religion and philosophy?
I think that's part of it, although obviously religion predates science. It's much older. So that used to be the dominant framework. But now we have science, and in particular neuroscience, we can use a different framework. It's not to say that religion doesn't have a place. It certainly does. But science can also help us go a bit deeper into understanding the causes of behavior.
Give us a good working definition of empathy.
So my definition of empathy has two components. The first is what psychologists call cognitive. It's the recognition of somebody else's thoughts and feelings. So that's all about putting yourself into someone else's shoes to imagine what they might think or feel. The second component is called affective, and that's the emotional reaction, that when you recognize what someone's thinking or feeling, it should also be accompanied by an appropriate emotional reaction. So not just recognizing that someone is in pain, but caring about it, wanting to alleviate their distress.
Most of us, of course, are able to do this without even giving it much conscious thought in most situations. Talk, though, about how empathy develops in neurotypical individuals.
Sure. I mean, we know that signs of empathy are there even in the first or second year of life. So child psychologists have done experiments where the mother, for example, pretends to hurt herself, maybe using a toy hammer, and she is pretending to nail a peg into a hole and hits her thumb and shows distress. And even a child of 18 months old will look up at the mother's face with a clear expression of concern and may even come over to the mother and try to comfort her. So you can see in the child's emotional expression in the face and in their behavior signs of compassion, of caring.
And obviously, in a functional family situation, that empathy would be reinforced over time by modeling from the parents.
That's right. So we know that there's a very close link between being able to trust other people as a child and the security of attachment, as it's called, between the child and their caregiver. So kids who are securely attached find it much easier to form those trusting relationships. And empathy does require an element of trust, obviously.
So you talk throughout this book about two different sets of problems that can interfere with typical development of empathy. And one of them is the autism spectrum, where, as we know, most people do not sort of grow up to want to hurt other people or to take any sort of pleasure in doing this. Can you talk about what separates that from things like psychopaths and sociopaths and narcissists?
Yeah, I mean, in one way, this is the controversial part of this book. because it's looking at the different kinds of medical conditions or psychiatric conditions that can lead to low empathy. And it also looks at the consequences for the individual. And as you've pointed out, different psychiatric conditions involve low empathy. Autism is one example. Psychopaths is another. So they're looked at side by side. But, you know, the conclusion that I come to in the book is that low empathy can lead to acts of cruelty, and we see that in the case of psychopaths. But low empathy doesn't necessarily lead to acts of cruelty, because people with autism, their low empathy doesn't push them to hurt other people. Usually it pushes them to avoid other people. They find the social world confusing, and so they tend to withdraw from other people. So those are two very different consequences of low empathy.
And when people on the autism spectrum are inclined to deal with other people, often they're drawn to systems of morality, really strict morality, as a way of sort of ordering the world around them.
That's right. So because they're not developing empathy in the usual way, they have to fall back on a different way of making sense of the world. And for people with autism, at least this is my suggestion, the way they try to make sense of the world is in terms of what I call systemizing. So figuring things out in terms of systems, how systems work. And it might be, for a child with autism, it might be a mechanical system. So they may devote all of their attention to figuring out how the family DVD player works, or the computer, or just watching a toy train going round and round on the railway tracks. But they may also look at people in highly systematic ways. And as you've mentioned, morality, a moral system, gives you another way to make sense of human behavior, learning the rules of right and wrong, for example.
Why doesn't that develop more often in people who lack empathy because of the other psychiatric conditions that we talked about?
Well, I think that the fact that we see a good moral compass in people with autism suggests that a moral sense is in some way independent of empathy. So empathy is one route to morality, but people with autism seem to care about other people. They care about justice and treating other people fairly. And they care about when bad things happen to others. It's just that they may have trouble reading facial expressions, trouble with some of the cognitive parts of empathy, as we talked about. The contrast case of psychopaths suggests that even though they can often figure out what someone is thinking or feeling, indeed they may be very good at that. They may be so good at it that they can deceive other people, but they're not developing the moral compass. So these are kind of two independent parts of the brain, if you like.
Simon, talk about how, as a scientist, you're able to measure something like empathy.
Well, there are lots of different ways now that we can look at empathy. So as a psychologist, we can look at it in terms of questionnaires, and people fill in questionnaires such as the empathy quotient, which shows that there's what we call an empathy bell curve, a spectrum, that we all fall somewhere on this scale, and most of us are in the middle, so with average scores, but there are some people who score super high and equally others who score very low. So that's a questionnaire approach. There are also performance tests where you can flash images up on the computer screen and ask the person to judge what the person is thinking or feeling just from looking at the person's facial expression, or listening to their tone of voice might be another test. So those are performance tests to see how good somebody is at decoding emotions. But then, of course, there's brain scanning. So with MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, we can give people those very same tests whilst they're lying in the scanner to see which parts of the brain are active when you're trying to put yourself in someone else's shoes and empathize.
And those, I guess, would be almost impossible to fool consciously.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, I don't think we should be lulled into believing that because it's high tech, it's therefore, completely incapable of or beyond error. But nevertheless, people aren't aware of which parts of the brain they're using. So in that sense, the person in the scanner is blind to how their brain is working. And it may even be that magnetic resonance imaging one day could be a better lie detector than the old-fashioned ones.
Hmm. I actually went online, and people who are interested can Google empathy quotient and find what I imagine is probably an abbreviated version of the test that you'd use in a clinical setting. But it was very interesting. And I was struck by wondering whether or not people are able to be pretty honest and self-aware about their own level of empathy as they're answering these questions.
Well, you raise a good point, because what goes hand in hand with empathy is self-awareness. I think when you have good empathy, you're obviously thinking about how other people feel, what they might be thinking, but you might also be thinking about what they think about you. So it's this extra level of reflection. And so someone who's low in empathy may not be very aware of how other people see them. And so in that respect, if you're filling out a questionnaire about your empathy and you've got low empathy, that could be, it could end up with the person rating their own empathy in an inflated way. They may believe they've got better social skills than they really have. So questionnaires have their limitations, and one solution to that is to get not just the person to fill in the questionnaire, but somebody else who knows them very well.
Oh, and then compare the two.
Yeah, and if you're getting a discrepancy, you could explore it further, and that's often what's done in a clinical assessment.
Another interesting element of the questionnaire is that you don't ask for age or education level or other things, but you do ask for gender. Why is that?
Well, in my previous book, which was called The Essential Difference, I did look at gender differences in terms of empathy. And it turns out that on many different measures, women score higher than men in terms of empathy. And if you look at children, girls are developing empathy faster than boys. So these are interesting phenomena, and there are a range of reasons why this might be happening, including genetics and hormonal factors.
So it also suggests that everybody needs some amount of empathy in order to function normally within society, but there may be pros and cons to being higher or lower on the spectrum?
I think that's right. One of the sort of questions I've had in my mind is why most of us end up with average empathy. And that may be because it's useful to have empathy in some situations, but equally, too much empathy may not be helpful. If you're so focused on other people's feelings, it may mean that you never really complete your own projects, which ultimately requires an element of being very self-centered.
And you could, I guess, be a basket case. If people around you were upset all the time, you would have a hard time ever getting your mind off that.
That's right. But you could see advantages to being at different points on the empathy scale, the empathy quotient. But what I argue in the book is that people who are very low in empathy, it tends to be negative. It tends to be negative for the individual, but also for people around them, that they can go on to hurt people. And we see this with many of the personality disorders, particularly, you've mentioned psychopaths, but there's another one called borderline personality disorder.
Let me jump in right here. We have to take a quick break. My
sure.
guest this hour is Simon Baron-Cohen. He's professor of developmental psychopathology and director of the Autism Research Center at the University of Cambridge. His new book is called The Science of Evil, On Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Simon Baron-Cohen. He is professor of developmental psychopathology and director of the Autism Research Center at the University of Cambridge. His latest book is called The Science of Evil, On Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. And Simon, before the break, you brought up the subject of people with borderline personality, which is this condition which, among other things, causes them to be very impulsive and to have a lot of mood swings and to see the world very much and people within the world in very black and white terms.
That's right. So when someone with borderline personality disorder is in an acute state, where all they can think about is themselves, and they might feel not just impulsive, but wanting to lash out in anger, it's often to people who are closest to them. And when they do that, it's often displaying a lack of empathy. So what I say in my book is that there are many routes to having low empathy, and borderline personality disorder is often the outcome of a very difficult childhood. 80% of people with borderline personality disorder have suffered neglect and abuse in childhood. So we're seeing a very clear illustration of the importance of an early nurturing environment for healthy empathy and what happens as a long-term outcome when somebody hasn't had that chance to form trusting relationships.
Well, that raises an interesting question. When people with these documentable psychiatric disorders who lack empathy, commit acts that we consider to be abhorrent, to what extent can we hold them accountable if their actions are the result of some kind of psychiatric disorder?
I think this is a really good question. And obviously, when someone ends up in the criminal justice system, they end up in court, for example, having hurt somebody, often the courts simply want to know, is the person guilty or not guilty? But they're not necessarily looking at the causes of the person's behavior. But if it's the case that the act of cruelty is just the end point after a lifetime of difficulties, including or resulting from the way the person's brain has developed, then maybe we should be thinking of the act of cruelty, not so much in legal terms, or not only in legal terms, but also in terms of disability, that the person has ended up with a neurological disability, and that instead of putting them in jail, for example, maybe we should be supporting them in the health care or social care services.
With appropriate care, can people be rehabilitated and develop a reasonable level of empathy?
Well, the old view used to be that people with psychopathic personality disorder or antisocial personality disorder or even borderline personality disorder were beyond treatment. But actually, there are many treatment trials now showing that even people with these personality disorders can benefit from psychological treatment. They can develop empathy and even recover to some extent.
Go ahead.
Well, it means that maybe we should be taking a more compassionate view to people who have made mistakes in their life.
Do these treatments tend to be talk therapy kinds of treatments, or are they drug-based?
Many of them are talk therapy-based. There's a new one that's been tried for patients with borderline personality disorder. It's called mentalization therapy, which encourages the patient to take another person's point of view, so not just always look at the world through their own eyes, as if that's all that matters, but to imagine what your child would be thinking at the moment you said certain things. And that prompting seems to actually lead to more reflection. There are other therapeutic approaches being tried. So you may know that in some prison systems, there's an attempt to bring the offender in contact with the abused victim. And again, that face-to-face contact of having to confront another person's feelings can often can promote better empathy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking this hour with Simon Baron Cohen about his new book, The Science of Evil, on empathy and the origins of cruelty. Let's go on the phones now to Jim in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Hello. I had wondered if there was any kind of scientific study or academic research that correlated attractiveness with sympathy or empathy, so that, you know, do good-looking people get more sympathy or empathy than ugly people?
What do you know about that, Simon?
It's a very interesting question, and I'm not aware of any results that talk to that. Although I'm sure there have been some studies. It's kind of depressing, isn't it? You know, the idea that maybe people who are less attractive might end up getting less of our empathy. And I must say that I'm full of admiration for nurses and others in the caring professions who can often show high levels of empathy even for people with physical disfigurement through their disabilities. So clearly it's not a complete barrier to showing empathy. But the short answer is I don't know of those studies.
So this whole subject, Simon, I think is really fascinating. But the questions that really plague me are the ones of people who are able to apply empathy appropriately in certain situations with certain people, but suspended in other cases. And to take a fictional example, you know, the television character of Tony Soprano. Are you familiar with the show The Sopranos?
No, I'm afraid that I haven't seen that over in the UK.
Okay, well, essentially he's a mobster, and so he can order a contract killing, or he can beat someone up with no problem, but he never lays a hand on his wife or his children.
Sure.
Can you talk about what you've learned about sort of situational empathy?
I think that's a good phrase, situational empathy. You know, we're all aware that our empathy fluctuates from day to day, or even at different times in the day, maybe according to whether we're tired or stressed or distracted. So, you know, if we're feeling relaxed, of course we can think about how other people are feeling. But if we're under pressure, it may be that we lose our empathy. And in the book, I discuss these temporary fluctuations in empathy, but I focus more on the enduring, permanent, or long-term low empathy. So these are kind of different states of mind. But you know, the character, the fictional character you described, I think we can all conjure up these kinds of images. You know, the Nazi guard who in the daytime is operating a death camp, but then at night goes home and reads bedtime stories to his kids. You know, it's suggesting that under different situations or different contexts, we may be able to apply empathy or fail to apply it. And the causes of that could be very complex. It could include social and even ideological causes, that if our society is telling us that a particular subgroup in the population doesn't warrant our empathy, maybe for a racial group, for example, if we are bombarded with that kind of propaganda, as does happen in some societies, we can end up treating that subgroup with less empathy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak with Ian. Hi.
Hello.
Ian. Hi, Ian, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yes, I'd like to ask your learned guest, is there any evidence to show that this empathy thing is related to intelligence, high intelligence and low intelligence, like somebody with 165 IQ and over, would they be less likely to be able to understand others' feelings, emotions?
Right. Actually, I think we've found the opposite, you know, that there's no real link between IQ and what we could call EQ, or your empathy quotient. That's another way of saying that you can find people of high intelligence who have good empathy, but so you can equally find people who have learning difficulties with high empathy. So it really does seem to be independent, and that's part of the excitement of the new area of neuroscience, finding that the empathy circuit in the brain seems to be somewhat independent of other other areas of the brain involved in reasoning.
And like so many other abilities that we have and develop over a lifetime, the empathy circuit gets stronger the more we exercise it.
That's absolutely right. So I certainly don't want to suggest that this is pre-programmed and that whatever level of empathy you're born with is the fixed amount. I think empathy is like many other skills, that with experience it gets better, with practice, and it's a bit like language, you know, that you need an environment in which to practice your empathy. So even if we're born with the capacity for language, we still need to hear speech and use speech and conversation to become fluent. And that's the same with empathy. We need relationships. That's almost the input to our empathy circuit in order to develop it.
So, Simon, we know that not everyone with autism spectrum disorders has special abilities. However, people on the higher functioning end of that often are known to be particularly intelligent or they have expertise in a particular area. Does the lack of empathy play into the development of those special mental skills when they exist?
One possibility is that there are actually two different factors in autism. So there's the factor contributing to their low empathy or difficulties with empathy, and then a second factor, which is to do with how they process information, that people on the autistic spectrum have excellent attention to detail and tend to focus on very narrow topics to go very deeply into them. And I spoke earlier about this tendency to systemize,
right,
that they want to understand how things work, and they're very quick at spotting patterns which might give clues to how something works. So one possibility is that the empathy difficulties are independent of the special talents or gifts that people with autism may develop. But the other possibility is that it's precisely because they need to systemize to such a high level, that's the way their brain works, that causes the empathy difficulty, because people's emotions are very hard to systemize. People's faces change very rapidly from one expression to another, and people may not show the same facial expression in different situations, even under the same circumstances. So it's hard to spot consistent patterns, unlike, for example, observing a machine which always operates in the same way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Dorothy in Fort Worth. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi, good afternoon. I work in the field of mental health. Specifically, I work with individuals with severe schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. My question to your guest is, what level of empathy can a person with severe schizophrenia express or have?
Sure. This is a very interesting question. And, you know, I would say that people with schizophrenia, you know, they experience many difficulties, as you know, on many different levels. Certainly their psychosis, you know, the fact that they're experiencing delusions and hallucinations is likely to interfere with their functioning at many levels. And there have been tests of empathy in people with schizophrenia showing that they have difficulties in accurately figuring out what someone else might think. They, for example, might become paranoid because they imagine other people are being hostile towards them when in fact they're not. So there's a very complex interplay between the delusions and their ability to empathize.
1-800-933-5372. We will go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Margie in Irving. Hi, Margie.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. I can't wait to read this book. We adopted two toddlers, 1.5 and 2.5, some years ago, and they were so-called special needs because they'd been repeatedly abandoned and addicted as infants, but otherwise being normal. And the older girl, 2.5, would seem to, she'd appear really great to everybody, but there was no depth of emotion. She really behaved as an animal trying to, I was told, trying to pick up on signals about how she should behave or what would get her what she wanted. And when they turned 13, each in turn, they started acting out. I mean, they wound up first with having to be institutionalized. They had the best mental health treatment Dallas has to offer. And that went on for many years. And eventually they wound up in the boy wound up in the prison system, and the girl's been flirting with that. She had six children and tried to kill one of them. And I spent part of my life trying to remove the children from her. That's all been done. But I was told that if a child does not bond within the first 18 months or so of life, they never form a conscience. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a heartbreaking story. And I'm sure anyone listening in is really moved by the sadness of this. You know, you did your best at adopting these two kids, and it may well be a very clear illustration of the importance of early attachment, that for whatever they'd experienced before you adopted them, it meant that they didn't have the key experiences that they need. I don't want to attribute everything to early experience, early environment, because part of what I explore in the book is also genetic factors. We don't really know much about these kids' biology. But either way, it's a heartbreaking story, and you know, I admire everything you've tried to do for them.
Simon Baron-Cohen is my guest. He's professor of developmental psychopathology and director of the Autism Research Center at the University of Cambridge. His new book is called The Science of Evil, On Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. We'll talk more about the book in just a moment. You can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is professor of developmental psychopathology and director of the Autism Research Center at the University of Cambridge, Simon Baron-Cohen. His newest book is called The Science of Evil, On Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Simon, you write that empathy acts as a sort of universal solvent to conflict. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, whether the conflict is happening between two individuals, if they're having a dispute or an argument, or if the conflict is happening between two companies or even two nation states, you know, I think if the individuals involved use empathy, it's often a much quicker and potentially cheaper solution to resolving that conflict. So often people resort to legal solutions in an attempt to resolve a conflict, or even military ones in the case of two nations. But you know, using empathy, it's available, it's natural, and all it involves is sitting down together to try to understand the other person's point of view.
Reading the book, it struck me that it's a good explanation for the intractable conflict we have in this country over abortion rights, because people who are in a pro-life position perceive a lack of empathy for unborn children on the part of pro-choice people. Pro-choice people perceive a lack of empathy on the part of pro-lifers for women who aren't prepared to bear unplanned pregnancies to term. Is that the problem, that everybody sort of doesn't see the empathy, only has empathy for one side of the debate?
I guess that's quite a good example, you know, where the pro-choice people are thinking about the mother, and the pro-life people are thinking about the baby. So they're both approaching the problem or the topic from slightly different points of view. And if you're ever going to get a resolution in that kind of debate, it is true that you have to set aside your own perspective and try to take on the other person's perspective.
We have an email here from Jacob in Dallas who writes, is there any documented correlation between empathy level and political or social orientation, such as conservative or liberal or party affiliation, or even degree of civic participation?
Yeah, I think I have to be a little bit careful with how I answer this question, because I would love to see such a study conducted. And I guess what the question is getting at is whether people with, say, higher levels of empathy are more likely to vote in one direction or another. You could imagine the results of such a study, but I haven't seen it conducted. I'd be very interested to know whether higher empathy, for example, is associated with being more liberal.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Katie in Dallas. Hello, Katie.
This is Katie.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I am wondering if on the autism spectrum variety of empathy or low empathy, when these kids can, the world can be a hostile place for kids on the spectrum. And I'm wondering if in a situation where they are made to feel safe, they're with people who they trust, they're being treated as if they're understood for who they are and their limits, are they able to develop greater empathy, or have you found anything that might enable these kids to develop their empathy level?
Right. Now, this is a really, really good question. What I've heard from many people with autism is that that in one-to-one relationships, they can often manage a level of empathy. So once they get to know somebody and trust them, and predict how another person will behave, they can often also tune into that person's feelings. The difficulty for people with autism often tends to occur in larger social groups. So one-to-one may be a bit simpler, but as soon as they're in, let's say, the playground at school, where there's a whole bunch of kids and they're having to figure out other people's thoughts and feelings in a complex, fast-moving, fast-changing situation, or at a party, where, again, the conversation may be going very quickly, jumping from one person to another, the social information may just be changing too rapidly for them.
Yeah, it makes sense that that would be challenging, given that they have to then understand the dynamics of people even outside the conversation they're having.
That's right, and also potentially figuring out people that they don't know very well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one thing to try to empathize with your parents or your siblings who you've spent many hundreds of days with, and you've learnt what provokes them to be angry or provokes them to be happy. But it's another thing to when you go to school and you're faced with the larger peer group.
Aside from what appears to be a genetic susceptibility, what are the greatest risk factors for people developing antisocial empathy problems?
Well, the famous studies were by John Bowlby, in the UK back in the 1950s, where he traced back people who had teenagers who had conduct disorders or delinquency, and found that many of them had disrupted childhoods, living in children's institutions or multiple foster families. So we talked earlier about the importance of stability and security of attachment, and that was really his contribution. But for my reading of the science is that early environment is part of the story. It's not the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And that biology also plays a role.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the line to Nikki in Dallas. Hey, Nikki. Hello, Nikki.
Hello. Hello. Yes, I want to comment, actually two comments. One is your question about why some people feel for some groups of people but not for the other one. I think the answer is actually the phenomenon called the in-group and out-group phenomenon. If it is in-group, you care for them. If it is an out-group, you don't care for them. And a good example is actually in a relationship between a marriage and after divorce. When you're in a marriage, you are in group, and therefore you care for them. But after a divorce, you change into an out-group, and you basically don't care about them. I think that's the difference. The second comment I have is that there was actually a study come out actually about 2 months ago studying the political versus empathy. And it turns out liberal people do have empathy part of the brain actually lit up.
Well, there you go. Maybe you can find the study, Simon.
Great. Well, that's, you know, just dealing with that second comment first. It links very directly to the earlier question we had. So that's nice to know that that study's been done, and I certainly will look it up. Although how it's going to be interpreted remains to be seen. But I guess you were talking about in-group, out-group relations. And, you know, that links to a question that Chris asked earlier. How can somebody show low empathy in one situation and high empathy in another? And in-group, out-group relations are a very good example of how our empathy changes according to who is the target, who is the person that we're empathizing with. And, you know, that could be based on ethnicity, how we define ourselves in terms of our ethnic group or membership to a particular social group. Or it could be, as you say, the very clear example you gave about marriage and how your empathy changes to your partner post-divorce. You know, that's another very good example. But these are social and, let's say, relationship-based causes to low empathy. And they contrast to more neurological and biological causes to low empathy.
Are there entire societies or cultures that appear to be more or less empathetic than others?
I think this kind of, you know, this question is getting at cross-cultural comparisons. And I'm always a bit nervous when psychologists or scientists start comparing one ethnic group or one society to another. I kind of wonder why they're doing it. What's the motivation?
Hmm.
I'm not aware that there have been studies looking at these cultural differences in empathy. And my guess, you know, if such a study was done, is that we would find that there's this familiar bell curve, the so-called normal distribution, that you'd see individual differences in any country or any ethnic group.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Donald in Fort Worth. Hi, Donald.
Hello. Hi. My name is Donald. Thank you for answering my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to tell you, first of all, I'm driving in a truck, so I can't hardly hear. I'm just going to ask my question and hang up and then turn up the radio, okay?
All right. Be safe, yes.
Okay. My father was a monster, just an absolute fiend to the family. He was always real concerned with other children. You know, he did... Well, I don't want to go into all that, but there were things that he did to help families and small children that was outside of our home. But for us, he was a monster. I mean, he was enormously physically abusive. He was verbally abusive. And I have a twin brother who is basically my best friend. We have come back together. We're both divorced. We don't know how to have relationships, I guess, but we have come back together, live in the same house together, and we talk a lot about our youth and growing up and the things that we experienced, and it seems to help us a lot. My question, I guess, is that how do I get back to have a relationship? I want to have empathy, but I don't really have it. I know I want it.
For your father, do you mean empathy for your father or empathy for other people in your life?
For us, that's what I say. I'm divorced and he's divorced.
Okay.
And
I think we got it. Let me have you stop there so that we can have a chance for, if you have any insights, Simon, is there anything that you would recommend to someone in Donald's situation?
Sure. I mean, it's another very painful story to hear about the long-term consequences of early abuse. And, you know, my heart goes out to you that you suffered as a child. Your story illustrates several things that have come up already in our conversation. Because one is that you were saying your father was capable of showing empathy to other children outside the family, even whilst he was abusive to his own children. So we have that situational fluctuation of empathy. But it's also illustrating these long-term effects. And I don't know whether you've tried any kind of psychotherapy or counseling, but often the goal of counseling is not just dealing with past difficulties, but also helping people to develop empathy. So, you know, I certainly would recommend going to a psychotherapist to talk about these things. It's great that you've got your twin brother, but there's a limit to what your brother can do for you, and it may be that somebody who's slightly independent and professional can help too.
We have an email from Jana in Dallas who wants to know if caring for pets plays a role in helping children develop empathy.
Absolutely. So that's another wonderful question, because empathy isn't just something that we direct towards people. We tend to direct empathy towards other animals too. And, you know, caring for a pet is a great opportunity to learn to think about another animal's point of view, another animal's state of mind, how to be gentle and how to avoid hurting other animals. Obviously, we're getting very different signals in our society if we're told that we can care for a pet, but then we can also eat animals or kill them for sport. Mm. So, you know, children must be getting mixed messages. But I think you know, the general point is that pets are a great way to encourage a child's empathy.
So I know that your research is on a faster trajectory than the books that you're able to write for us in the general audience. But can you talk about what questions are really interesting you the most now with regard to this subject?
You're right that science, you know, goes much more quickly than popular science, if you like. But the current questions we're looking at are actually following up that gender difference that we mentioned earlier, because I'm particularly interested in whether hormones are contributing to our empathy, and in particular the so-called male hormone, testosterone, but not just the testosterone that we all have postnatally, but actually the hormone that's produced by the baby in the womb.
Hmm.
Because there's a lot of evidence that at that stage of development, the hormone is changing the way the brain develops, that testosterone masculinizes the brain. That's a shorthand. And we're particularly interested by measuring that hormone during pregnancy.
Well, it'll be interesting to follow that. I'm sorry to jump in because we're out of time.
Sure.
Simon Baron-Cohen is professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge. The new book is The Science of Evil, on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. Simon, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for this hour.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.